From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 100 years ago this week, tomorrow, April 24th, 1915, it all began. The mass killing of Armenians in Turkey that would come to be understood by many as genocide. The first modern genocide. As many as 1.5 million killed. We have two authors with us today with two different takes, one fiction, one nonfiction, on the slaughter, its aftermath, and its tragic resonance still today. This hour on Point, memory, aftermath, and grappling with the Armenian genocide. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What is important to say here, a century on? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Lots of talk about this lately. The Pope himself mentioning this earlier in April at a mass for the centenary of the mass killings. Pope Francis addressed the World War I era killings of Armenians by Ottoman Turks. Here's the Pope interpreted by Reuters.
La nostra umanità.
In the past century, our human family has lived through three massive and unprecedented tragedies.
Grande tragedie inaudite. La prima.
The first, which is widely considered the first genocide of the 20th century, struck your own Armenian people.
Pope Francis says genocide. President Obama, lately not going to that word. He did, though, as a senator and presidential candidate. Here he was at a breakfast briefing in April of 2007, responding to a question from a member of the Armenian-American community.
For those of you who aren't aware, there was a genocide that did take place against the Armenian people.
There was a genocide. That was candidate Senator Barack Obama. And here, Turkey's foreign minister spoke this week in an interview with CNN's Jake Tapper. Tapper asked him why Turkey wouldn't recognize the killings as the genocide. Here was the foreign minister saying what happened was not, in the legal sense of the word, he said, genocide.
We are not denying that so many people died, but we cannot characterize what happened as genocide. And it is not up to those parliaments and the politicians to decide whether it was a genocide or not. It's a legal term.
And the centenary now right in front of us. Joining us from New York, first Eric Bogosian, actor, playwright, writer of Armenian descent. You may know him from his roles on Law and Order and Talk Radio. His new book is Operation Nemesis, the assassination plot that avenged the Armenian genocide. Eric Bogosian, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you here.
Thanks, Tom. Great to be back.
And from Culver City, California, Liddy Matthew is with us. Her new novel is The Musician's Secret. It jumps from Armenia into the heart of the American Armenian immigrant community. Liddy Matthew, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hi, Tom.
Eric, I didn't know you were a historian, but here you are with a great big history of the aftermath years of the genocide. What is it you're tracking?
Well, I'm tracking a little-known conspiracy of Armenians, mainly small businessmen in the United States and former veterans and other men familiar with using arms, who together knocked off a big chunk of the Turkish leadership after World War I. The conspiracy operated not far from where you're sitting in Watertown, Massachusetts. They sent agents all over Europe, to Berlin, to Rome, Constantinople, to Tbilisi, and gunned down a number of the leaders, including especially Talat Pasha, also Jamal Pasha, Said Halim Pasha. These were men who were running Turkey during World War I, and they did this in 1921 and 1922.
This was vengeance for what is today called by so many the Armenian Genocide.
Yes. Of course, at that time, these men who did this, who ran the assassination plot, were not looking at it in the way we see it today. I mean, what they had witnessed was this massive destruction of their communities, their villages, their towns, their families, all so many people wiped out. They were reeling from what had just happened under the fog of war. And they felt compelled to do something. So they formed this secret cabal, and they very carefully tracked these leaders and assassinated them. And what is even more remarkable, almost none of them served any prison time for this. Most of them ended up surviving to old age, a number of them in California, actually.
Even when one of them was put on trial, we'll look at that. Liddy Matthew in California. Here's Eric Bogosian writing history, little-known history, in the aftermath of the enormous death toll here. You're writing about a much longer arc of time through a lens of fiction, but about, do we call it the diaspora or Armenians who scattered all over, and especially to many here in our backyard in Watertown, Massachusetts, and many also in the United States in Glendale, California, about how this story and history traveled, Liddy.
Yes. You know, the action of the story, the novel, it takes place in 1992. But those assassinations of the 20s really do influence the main characters, especially the younger one, the blackmailer. So it's in the psyche, and you know, it's still in the community.
You have a musician who at this point, he was very young during the years of killing, genocide. Now he's an old man. He plays this very, very typical Armenian instrument, the duduk. We're going to hear some of that in a few minutes. We're going to have some live here in the studio. He has a secret. We won't tell it, but somebody's on to it. And through the lens of his story, he's a famous player of this culturally important instrument. What's the story you're trying to tell us, Liddy?
You know, at heart, it's a story. Yes, it takes place in the Armenian community, but it's stuff that we can all relate to. It's about our desire to be seen for who we really are. And when I think of big themes or, you know, something terrible like genocide, I think that it's when someone cannot see you for who you really are. You can't really understand that humanity of someone else. That's when terrible things happen.
Eric, I've read you saying there are issues here when so many die of culture just being knocked away, knocked out, holes being left in a culture.
Well, that's a big part of genocide. The attempt is to wipe out not only the physical people, but their culture, their religion. Obviously, there was a religious component, obviously, to this.
This was a Christian community in a Muslim land.
Yes. So, and the attempt is to just get rid of every vestige and memory of the people. Memory, very important. If you travel in Turkey today, there are scores of museums that purport to be archaeological history museums. There's actually 50 of them in Turkey. And if you go in there, you will learn the history of the land, Anatolia, Asia Minor, going back thousands of years. There is no mention whatsoever of Armenians in these museums in Turkey. It is astounding. And it is all part of the denial that is ongoing in Turkey that anything of, I mean, let's look at it this way. There were millions of Armenians living in this region prior to World War I. There were only tens of thousands by the end of the war. And the people were wholesale either slaughtered, moved out, as you said, put on these deportation caravans that they couldn't survive. And so this is genocide in and of itself, including the denial that comes at the end.
Eric, I know from talking with people in advance of this show that a lot of people are very murky on the geography of this and some of the fundamental history behind it. I mean, first of all, we're talking about it quite the Armenian heartland being in those days what was largely within what is now Turkey. This, at its greatest extent, a pretty big swath of land from the Caspian Sea to the Mediterranean, from almost the Black Sea to pretty well down toward Iran, Iraq, Syria. Today you've got an Armenia that is independent, that is east of the eastern Turkish border. But these were overlapping zones at the time of 1915, Eric.
Yes, it's actually in many ways parallels what we see today with the Kurds, in that the Armenians, their homeland stretched out over regions, political areas of Eastern Ottoman Empire, Russia, northern Iran, and there were Armenians all over the region. There are still plenty of Armenians in the Russian component and the Persian component, but in the area that was the Ottoman Empire and is now today the Republic of Turkey, the Armenians were moved out. of course, all these boundaries have been moving over the last century, and this was the back end of the story of World War I, was how the whole Middle East got reconfigured. So, yeah, the Armenians are a people who, over millennia, have either occupied vast areas of what we call Turkey today, and now there is the Republic of Turkey, which is in the Republic of Armenia, which is in the Caucasus and is only a fragment of the original Armenian homeland.
We've just got a few seconds. We'll come back to this. But before the break, Eric, as a boy growing up Armenian-American, did you grow up fully aware of this, feeling the weight of genocide in your culture, your family's history?
I heard the stories from my grandfather, who told me horror stories when I was very small about what had happened to him and what he had seen as a young man in Turkey. I didn't really know what to do with this information. It was almost like the Game of Thrones from my perspective as a young American kid.
Eric Boghossian is with us from New York. His new book is Operation Nemesis, the assassination plot that avenged the Armenian genocide. Liddy Matthew is with us in Culver City, California. Her new novel is The Musician's Secret. The main character there plays the duduk, Armenian instrument. A little of that behind us right here, Dile Yaman from Divan Gasparian. You can hear a sad kind of longing in this bit. We're going to hear more of that. And live in this hour, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about memories and the impact of the Armenian genocide 100 years on, the mass killing that began a century ago tomorrow, April 24th, 1915, with two writers who have looked at the killing and the long tale of all that, and a musician in a few minutes who's helping keep the culture alive. Eric Boghossian is with us, Armenian-American author of Operation Nemesis, the assassination plot that avenged the Armenian genocide. Liddy Matthew is with us from Culver City, California, lives in Glendale, big concentration of Armenian-Americans there. Former journalist, she's written for the Los Angeles Times and more. Her new novel is The Musician's Secret. You can read an excerpt of each of those books at our website, onpointradio.org. Liddy, Eric, lots of callers for the two of you, and Martin Harutunian joins us in a moment as well. Liddy, you married into an Armenian family. Could you feel the weight of this history as you began an American marriage?
Wow, that's a great question, and I've never been asked that before. And yes, whether it was intentional or not, when you marry into such an old culture, it comes with an unspoken, in a set of luggage. Mm-hmm. And for me, there was such a fascination with the Armenian culture, just because it has these rituals and stories and myths that are, you know, it's very old, but still it's practiced in modern day. And my favorite example of that is, like, you know, when I'd accidentally drop bread on the floor and a distant relative would say, "Hey, wait a second, pick up that piece of bread. You know, you don't want to, you know, feed the evil spirits in the ground." And, you know, when I think of L.A. and this mixing of culture, you know, that's something that I might now say to my niece or nephew that are not Armenian. "Hey, pick up that piece of bread."
The culture flows through.
Right.
Call us for the two of you. Michael in Arlington, Massachusetts. Michael, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, yeah. You know, at the time, it was recognized as a genocide. My dad, who was from Sicily, when I was quite young, would talk to me about it. And he saw it as a precursor of the Jewish Holocaust. And also, the highest authority that one could think of on the matter thought it was a precursor. At a meeting shortly before or after the infamous Winterse conference where the final solution was decided upon, Hitler said to the group assembled, "Well, let's go ahead and do this. Who remembers the Armenians?"
The highest authority on this. I mean, in a sense, I know what you're saying. It's ironic, but you're exactly right. That's how he saw it. That's how he called it. And the implications maybe for the Jews were large. Eric Boghossian, this has been said many times. The Pope sort of made a similar reference here. This, in a way, in the 20th century, this kicked it off.
Well, we're talking about Raphael Lemkin here, who created the term genocide, and it was became part of the international lexicon in the 1940s. Mm-hmm. So it's true that from that point on, and the Armenian genocide was considered a genocide. The Lemkin referred to it himself when he was defining the term. He said it was a prime example. And then over time, the term became more and better understood. At the time of it actually happening during World War I, even Armenians who were there weren't fully aware of how massive and horrific this centrally organized destruction of the nation was. I mean, my own grandparents, as a little boy, they would tell me the stories from their towns and villages, but they didn't completely understand how thorough it was. For example, my grandmother, she would say that her father went into the army and never came back. She didn't understand the system of killing young Armenian men by drafting them into the army, disarming them, and then murdering them in the hinterlands, which was a major component of this genocide. It was a great way to get rid of all the young able-bodied men, was to draft them in the army and then kill them there, or put them in labor battalions and then kill them. So this is an ongoing study to really understand exactly what happened. And this research has been accelerated over the last 20 years as certain archives open up. The German archives have opened now, and we can see the structure of what the Young Turks were doing vis-a-vis the Armenians.
Building a new nation there, and a big price paid. You describe your grandfather describing what he was 21 years old and watching as his village burned while he and his mother were crouched down in the middle of a wheat field hiding there. Paul in Littleton, Massachusetts. Paul, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. It's great to talk with you. I'm a second-generation Armenian-American. My family history is intimately tied to what happened in Turkey and Armenia in the early 1900s. My grandfather came over in like 1905 after the first wave of history or pressure against the Armenians, and my grandmother came over in 1915. So my question is, what was the genesis of the whole conflict between the Armenians and the Turks and the Young Turks and the government? Because I've never learned that part of the history. My impression of it is that Armenians were trying to get their own independence, and they were siding with the Soviet Union and Russia at the time. So I'm so curious about what the genesis of the conflict was. And I wonder if any of your guests have information about that.
Sure, Paul. Thank you, Eric. There's an Armenian American who knows very well what happened, but doesn't really understand why. I'm sure many are in that same boat. Can you help us?
I am sympathetic, because when I began the project, I really didn't know. It's complicated. And one of the challenges of writing the book was to lay this out in a way that people could understand what was happening. In fact, it's wrong to think of the Young Turks as these barbaric, bloodthirsty characters.
I think
they
better define all of our terms here, because even Young Turks, maybe
young
leave
Turks,
somebody wondering, well, who, what?
The Young Turks, or the CUP, the Committee for Union and Progress, ran Turkey during the war and just prior to the war. And they were, think in terms of They were a political party, like the National Socialists were in Germany. They had taken over the government. It was a constitutional government by that point. They had had a little sort of revolution in 1908 and put the Sultan in the back seat. And there was now a constitutional monarchy in the Ottoman Empire at the beginning of World War I. But it was not a completely legal constitutional monarchy, just as in Germany, as Hitler and his cronies mm-hmm. took over there. It wasn't entirely legal and involved assassinations and killings and so forth. But this all goes back to the 19th century. It's a complicated story. I would say go look in my book. But let's just say it was political. There were all kinds of economic pressures happening between our Armenians and Muslims in the Ottoman Empire. And essentially this pressure built up to the point where the Young Turk government felt that one solution would be to simply get rid of all the Armenians and they wouldn't have to deal with it anymore. Now, many people, obviously, the Ottomans and the Turks, they are Muslim and the Armenians are Christian. But this wasn't only about Christian-Muslim tension. That was used to foster animosities between groups. But the key thing is that people very high up in the government felt that they could solve the Armenian problem, which was what to do with this Christian population that wanted representation in the government. Not an independent country. There was nobody really looking for that at the time. Maybe that would have been something in the future. But Armenians considered themselves to be part of the Ottoman Empire. There was, just as the Kurds are part of Turkey today, and they just wanted to participate. And there was a movement toward this representational constitutional government. Unfortunately, there were also vested interests who didn't want things to go that way. It's not a simple story, but the important thing to remember is that political characters made decisions to remove these people altogether, remove the Armenians, and then they wouldn't have that problem any longer.
And as your book tells the story, Armenians in the aftermath went after those political leaders, assassinated many. Liddy Matthew, you bring the emotional import to this to us through a musician and his instrument, the duduk. Describe the position that this instrument plays in Armenian culture.
Well, the duduk is a 5,000-year-old instrument, maybe even older. And it's this double-reed woodwind that's made of apricot wood, and that's very important. And there's a way that's played that I'm sure we'll hear later. It's often played in pairs, where the first player plays the melody while the second player plays the dam, which is the steady drone. But that combination creates this haunting sound. And if sadness could be an instrument, it would be the duduk.
We've heard it in a lot of Hollywood films.
Yes, that's true. And in fact, that's where why I got interested in it. My husband and I were actually watching, it was actually Battlestar Galactica. And all of a sudden, this really, like, I think Caprica is burning in the back. And there's this beautiful, like, but sad sound that comes across. And he turns to me and Melkon says, "Hey, that's the duduk." And I thought, wow, that's crazy. And I wanted to find out why this ancient shepherd's flute was showing up in these Hollywood instruments. So I set out to interview a bunch of musicians, like Jivan Gasparian. We heard him play Dalai Laman, and a couple of composers. And, you know, what they were telling me was that the duduk could convey this emotion of sadness without, like, having to use words. And for me, the duduk is the human voice without the encumbrance of words.
You may have heard it in Battlestar Galactica or Gladiator. You'll hear it right now with us on Point. Liddy Matthew, stand by in California, and Eric in New York with me in the studio. I'm so happy to have him here. Martin Hartunian. Hartunian is here. Musician, student of Armenian folk music, performs and teaches traditional Armenian woodwind and percussion instruments. He's director of the Arev Armenian Folk Ensemble. Martin Hartunian, it's so wonderful to have you here, and I see a duduk in your hands.
Hi, Tom. My pleasure. Thank you. Yes, this is the duduk.
It's a beautiful instrument. It's in some ways simple, but its sound is so evocative. When you play, and I'm going to ask you to play it in just a moment here, maybe something that might evoke the pain of the genocide that's being remembered this week? Is it an instrument that lends itself to sorrow, or does it have the whole gamut?
No, it actually it does have the whole gamut. The duduk can express pain, sorrow, as well as joy. I think it's gotten a bad rap in some respect. Always associating with sorrow. But then again, the history of the Armenian people is full of sorrow. So I can see that.
Will you play us? We'll hear both, but play us something that might evoke. Here we are. Tomorrow's the 100th anniversary, the beginning of a terrible, terrible time of killing. So something you might play a bit of for us
sure.
to feel that.
Well, as Lydia mentioned earlier, the duduk is traditionally played in pairs with one instrument holding a drone. And that drone is played using a technique called circular breathing, where you're mm-hmm. actually breathing in and breathing out at the same
while
time.
While you're playing.
Mm-hmm. While you're playing. Unfortunately, I don't have an accompanist with me today, but I will play a little bit of a melody. It's called Hovivik Anch, which means Call of the Shepherd.
Please. Playing the duduk with me in the studio here, kind of the iconic Armenian instrument in many ways. Lydia, does it put you in the midst of your story to hear that sound, in the midst of the kind of tone poem that runs through your novel?
It does. For almost a decade, I kept thinking about this instrument, and it was that sound, because there's something vaguely human about it. And in fact, the main character of my book, who is this 84-year-old duduk player, duduk master, mm-hmm. he does so much in his life, and it's really to be with the duduk.
Eric, when you were young, did you respond to that sound, or was that the musty old Armenian old country you wanted nothing to do with it?
It was a part of me. It wasn't a matter of me wanting to be part of it or not. I mean, when I went to weddings or I went to particularly that melodic line is typical of what you would hear in church during the Badarak, the ceremony of the liturgy. And it was so haunting, and it was so... of course, I don't know enough about music, but I know it's some other scale than the Western scale. Mm-hmm. I honestly don't know those things, but... you could feel it deep in your soul. It went into my bones. And it's true that as I got older, I was thinking, hey, look, I'm just an American kid. I'm not what this whole Armenian thing. I don't even know what it means. And then in the 90s, I had done this movie with Atom Ogoyan, and I got stirred up. My roots got stirred up. And I had to admit that as much as I was just some kid who used to hang out at the mall and smoke pot, I was also the little kid who had been there next to my grandfather, the survivor, watching him cook shish kebab in the backyard. And it's all me. And this is very much me. I'm sitting here right now. I feel it inside my soul when I listen to that music. It's pretty incredible. It is us. It is Armenia.
And the grandfather that watched his village burn, hiding in the wheat field. Eric Boghossian, author of Operation Nemesis, Please Stand By in New York. Lily Matthew in Culver City, California, author of The Musician's Secret. Martin Harutunian with his wonderful duduk right here in the studio with me. Here's Gevorg Dabagian playing a little more duduk behind us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you. everybody, Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about memories and the impact of the Armenian Genocide 100 years on, the mass killings that began a century ago tomorrow, April 1915, with two writers who have looked at the killing and the long tale that followed. Eric Boghossian is with us, author of Operation Nemesis, a new book looking at the assassination plot that avenged, as the title has it, the Armenian Genocide. Lily Matthew is with us from Culver City, California, lives in Glendale, California, one of the big concentrations of Armenian Americans in this country, along with Watertown, Massachusetts. Her new novel is The Musician's Secret. The protagonist there, a famous 84-year-old player of the duduk, the Armenian flute. We have an Armenian flute player as well with us in the studio, Martin Harutunian. He's already played for us a bit. I hope he'll play some more with a beautiful, beautiful flute, symbolic of Armenian culture. Another symbol lately in popular culture anyway, Kim and Khloe Kardashian, along with Kanye West and a couple of cousins, paid a visit to the ancestral home of their father, Robert Kardashian, earlier this month. They were met the Armenian prime minister, visited the Armenian Genocide Museum, and here's the sound of them mobbed by fans in Armenia. Culture, pop culture, all mixed together at one time there. You can join the conversation this hour. How do tragedies like this echo, matter a century on? How do you hang on to a culture when so much is lost? And what made it to America with Armenian immigration? What didn't? What's important to remember here 100 years on? Let me go to Greg in Wethersfield, Connecticut. Greg, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Well, I just wanted to share with you, I'm a third generation Armenian American, and I want you to, it's hard to understand. A lot of people think this is old history, but the Turkish government, modern-day Turkish government, the government that had nothing to do with the actual events of 1915 to 1923, the government persistence that this never happened or it was a civil war or the Armenians were traitors and that they got what they deserved, it caused pain for the people that survived and for many of their descendants. I don't know how to describe it, but the Armenian Genocide has remained an open wound on the Armenian psyche, in large part because the successor Turkish regime has persisted in its denials and counter accusations that the Armenians were the guilty party and the Armenians committed genocide against the Muslims.
Greg, I appreciate your call. Eric Boghossian, the consensus seems to have come strongly toward genocide in recent years. I mean, not as though Wikipedia is the final judge, but it is a battleground. And if you look there, they're saying it's acknowledged to have been one of the first modern genocides because scholars point to the organized manner in which the killings were carried out. How do you interpret the ongoing Turkish resistance to this descriptor, this way of seeing it, Eric?
The Turkish government does what it is doing for two reasons. First of all, they are strategic to the interests of the West. Turkey sits in a very particular place in the world between Russia, Iran, Iraq, very close to the oil fields near Israel. And we have bases there.
But this was 100 years ago. Couldn't they say yes? I mean, Germany said, yes, the Holocaust happened and they're close American allies. There must be an ongoing dynamic that makes it problematic.
They just it's because they can, and also because we have not stood up to them. I think it's absurd that the United States, the most powerful country in the world, is allowing the tail to wag the dog. What are they going to do if our president, the president of the United States, the most powerful man in the world, says the word genocide? What are they going to do? They're going to close the bases? The truth is the Republic of Turkey needs its connection to the West. It is the recipient of tens and tens of millions of dollars of aid and armaments over the decades. And it's really at this point, and that's the second reason, it's because we choose not to, the spinelessness of our State Department, to be cowed by them. Now, having said that, we are at a very particular moment in time with the horror show known as ISIS. And once again, I'm sure in the back rooms, Turkey is saying, if you want flyovers, if you want to be able to arm your troops or your planes or whatever, then you have to stick with the program, which is to go along with this crazy idea. That is to say, there was no genocide. Look, if you're going to define the term genocide, if the term means anything, then you must include what happened to the Armenians, because it is part of the definition of the term. But they choose not to. There is anger toward the Armenians for acts that were committed in the 1980s. There were groups committing violence at that time, again, trying to bring the genocide to the consciousness of the world. There is tension.
Terror,
but
you
overall,
call it.
Overall, they're doing it because they can.
You call it Armenian terror at that time. You say it in your book, Eric.
Well, that was. I mean, the Armenian groups that were operating in this way were extreme fringe groups. We have to understand that. Mm-hmm. But they did commit bombings and killings. That, you know, all of this, whether there's ever Armenian resistance or activity, it would be like blaming the Jews for uprising in the Warsaw Ghetto. It's absurd. Of course, oppressed people are going to try in whatever way they can to some people are going to resist. And in the case of the Armenians, if we go back to 1915, you're talking about thousands of people as opposed to the millions of people who lived in the region. Because there are some people who choose to resist the Ottoman Empire, and I'm talking, again, thousands of people, is that a reason to take every man, woman, and child, and I'm talking children, taking children and murdering them? Not just we're talking tens of thousands of children and young women and elderly people, and taking them into the desert and cutting their throats or throwing them into ravines or tying them together and throwing them into rivers. Is that a justification? Of course it isn't. Of course it isn't. But this is where we are today. The genocide argument is going to eventually be surrounded by so much fact that they just won't be able to exist anymore. Already Turkey is in a position where their civil society has butted up against this problem. People in the universities, they can't teach history because the minute they do any interface with another university, they're stuck with their fake history that they have created. It's a very powerful propaganda machine within Turkey, but it just doesn't connect to anything outside of Turkey. So eventually it will fall to pieces. It's not going to happen this year, but it will happen eventually. An important component of helping us move this along, this ridiculous situation, is actions such as what the Pope said the other day. And now it's incumbent on our leadership. The United States, by the way, has recognized the genocide in the past. It's just what we're talking about today's State Department, today's president, who choose to take this line, which is really, they should just move on. Say the word, say what happened.
Let me go to Lisa in Newton, Massachusetts. Lisa, thank you for calling.
Thanks very much. I want to make what I think is a really important point that is often overlooked in this discussion. My grandparents were both survivors of the genocide. I'm a second generation Armenian American. My mother didn't know how to speak English when she went to kindergarten, but my grandfather, at the age of 11, you know, fled his village with his uncle, left his mother and rest of his family behind, and fled first to Alexandria, Egypt, and then here. But before he left for a period of time. He pretended to be Muslim, and he underwent circumcision. He took an Islamic name. Mm-hmm. And for all that, to the end of his life, he wanted the Turkish government to acknowledge that the genocide had occurred. He wanted there to be recognition. I want to say that I grew up with tales of gratitude from my own grandfather about the kindness and assistance that his Turkish friends and neighbors had given to him in helping him to sort of hide in place and then to get out. And I can't think that our family is the only one. The other point I want to make is, you know, this, what happened to the Armenians, the disruption of our lives, also goes right to the heart of our identity, because they weren't just Armenian. They were also, you know, part of their culture was Turkish, to the mm-hmm. point that in lots of households, many of us second generations grew up hearing our grandparents speaking either Turkish and Armenian, or Armenian smattered with Turkish words. So, you know, this, I'd just like to make the point that I think there are a lot of Armenians that do feel strongly that the government acknowledged the genocide, and yet we have heard and grown up hearing stories of assistance provided by Turkish friends and neighbors. And I'll take comments.
Thank you, Lisa. Terrible killing, but a more sort of nuanced perspective on it as well there from a second-generation Armenian-American. One more, Inocencio in Miami Beach. Inocencio, thank you for calling from Florida.
Yes. Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking the call. And bear with me, I'm a little nervous. But I'm a second-generation Assyrian, that's with a capital A.
Yes.
And there were two additional primary ancillary ethnic minorities that were also targeted in the Armenian genocide, and that was the Pontic or Christian Greeks mm-hmm. and the Assyrians, who mm-hmm. are also Christian, but also a separate ethnic identity with our own culture and language. And we were also targeted. So about 750,000, a huge chunk of our people, were massacred and killed in that genocide as well. And so I'm so thankful that Mr. Boghossian is doing what he's doing now, but I have to say I'm a little hurt that he used the example of the Kurds, because the Assyrians are also a people without a country, and were also victims and deliberate targets of the genocide, as well as the Armenians and the Pontic Greeks.
Innocencia,
currently being threatened with massacre and just complete elimination by the ISIS is trying to destroy us
even right now.
Face of the earth.
Yeah.
Yeah, right now.
That's an important.
Now a 100-year anniversary. They're trying to. It's happening to us again. Thankfully for Armenia, they have their own country, and so does Greece has their own country. The Assyrians don't have their own country, and nobody cares.
Innocencio, we've got it. And Eric, I hear you sympathetically there.
Well, absolutely. I apologize if I'm not being as completely thorough as I can be, as we're talking very quickly mm-hmm. on the radio. It's there in the book. And what happened to the Syriac Christians, the Nestorians, the Chaldeans, is just as horrible, obviously, and very much the resonance, the echo that's happening right now with ISIS just tears my heart in half, because these people, they have lived in these regions for thousands of years in these small villages. The Syriac Christians are the oldest Christians, even older than Armenians, and they have lived this humble Christian life in these hills forever. And now this horror show, this ISIS, comes through and just wipes out entire communities. It is sad because, A, it's just so horrible that this is happening to these innocent people. But also, as an Armenian, I know that this is an exact echo of what had happened 100 years ago. And how is that possible? I don't have the answers to this sort of thing, but I sort of focus on what I can talk about. And I write about this assassination squad and what they did, because that was my focal point with the book. But I try, with my book anyway, to reach out into all of these contextual, these related terms, because there's something going on in the Middle East that's even larger than all of this. And this is this endless homogenization of these multifarious countries and areas where all these people have lived together peacefully for thousands of years, and these political entities come along with these crazy ideas of Turkification or Islamization, and they destroy, ruin these regions by killing all the Christians, making all the Jews leave, whatever it is that they're making have happen. And it's really, really sad, because the Middle Eastern culture is a beautiful culture. And we should, as Lydia is doing, we should embrace the positives. The positives are how amazing this culture is, what an amazing place this area of the world is.
Martin, your grandfather left Armenia before the big killing began, made it to the United States, but his dreams were shattered anyway by what transpired.
That's right. My grandfather came from the city of Antep, which is in which was part of the Ottoman Empire, Western Armenia, today Turkish occupied Armenia, and he left there to find a better life in the United States. But when he heard of what was happening, he actually returned back and participated in the self defense of his community there, and luckily was able to save part of his family and then make it back to the United States. The genocide is something that has affected all of the lives of every single Armenian, I think.
Liddy, I'm reading, you asked your husband the other day, Armenian-American, over breakfast, what's the worst thing about what we're remembering now on the centenary, all the killing? And what was his reply?
It was interesting. It was a touchy question, and to ask, and I didn't know what his answer was going to be, and he was silent for so long that I almost thought he wasn't going to answer the question. And so then he said, it's all the missing people. Like they're there, but the memory of them, or what they contributed has been erased. And it's for a very old culture like the Armenians, it's a monumental loss, because you know that you had this, this very rich past and this genealogy, family members that you could trace back, maybe hundreds of years. And now all of a sudden it's gone. And there are those holes that Eric talked about.
The missing people, the holes. And as Eric Boghossian says, all this on the centenary in the context of a new time in which we see communities being wiped out. I'm so grateful to all three of you for joining us to bring this rich, sad, but rich tapestry of memory to us today. Liddy Matthew, the new novel is The Musician's Secret. Liddy, thank you so much for joining us from California today.
Thank you.
Eric Boghossian's new book is Operation Nemesis, the assassination plot that avenged the Armenian genocide. Eric, it's good to talk with you again, and thank you for being with us.
Great to talk with you again, Tom.
And Martin Harutunian, who's brought his beautiful duduk in today. This is from his River of Collections recording. Martin, thank you so much for your musicianship, your memories as well.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.